Tonight, as always, it's a privilege to be able to stand for the Lord and to share what He has done for us and to share from His Word. I thought that I would give you an update as far as a future date, as most of you are very well informed about the camp and kept abreast of all the things that are going on. And just give you some things to be looking towards and praying about. As already mentioned, the women's and men's retreat will be this month. The ladies' retreat this weekend. And then 2 weeks later will be the men's retreat. So be praying much for that. Trust you plan to come and be a part. And then about a month later, we'll be having the Thanksgiving retreat. And then that will conclude with the young adult retreat, which we started last year. And we're looking forward to that again, as we have several who have indicated an interest in coming and being a part of the young adult retreat. So do be praying for that as the young people are studying. And then in the new year, the volleyball, basketball, all-night marathon is January the 5th, going into the 6th. The Altoona all-night skating and bowling is February the 2nd and the 3rd. Sometimes we have a group that plans to go from here and to go up and spend the night and enjoy the activities. The Lancaster All-Night Skate and Bowl is the next month then, March the 2nd and the 3rd, and do make plans to be a part of that. And then our Easter retreat will be an unusual time, the first week in April, April the 6th and 7th, and do be praying for that. And then our auction will be Saturday, May the 5th. And then we are going to have family camping over Memorial Day weekend. Last year we had an increase in that. Had about 65 people, young adults and others as well. And some of the new people that we've met at school. And we've seen an increase in that. And we hope to push that more this year. And as the Royal Rangers have been forced to go back to their camps and their denomination, and so we'll have more room for family camping. So make that a matter of prayer, giving you plenty of time to mark down in your calendars and to plan to be with us and be a part of that May the 25th through the 28th. And then as we look at our summer camps, our summer season is already full for next year, and in fact we have added, Lord willing, two more camps to fill out the end of August and the 1st of September. And so we give the Lord praise for that, as this last summer was the biggest summer that the camp had ever had. And if the Lord is gracious, this year should top that, as we're adding two more camps. Our own camps will be August the 5th through the 10th, and that will be mini junior and teen week, as we plan to combine those groups together, hoping that we'll have one large number, and then also helping us with our counselors and those that will be helping and participating. And then following that, August the 12th through the 17th will be our specialty camps, and we are adding three new specialty camps this year to give us six different camps that will be running the same week. And so we ask for your prayers as we work out the logistics of that and as we clarify exactly what the new ones will be. Do make that a matter of prayer, and then encourage your young people to come and to be a part of that. And then our fellowship banquet next year, 2007, will be Saturday, September the 15th. And so you can't say you didn't know about it and that no one told you. I'm telling you almost a year ahead of time. And so that's the things that are lined up for us, Lord willing. And of course, if He comes back, then we won't worry about all of that schedule, and we'll be thankful that He has. But busy time. We thank the Lord for His goodness and His grace and His mercy. And we thank Him for all that He's done and for what He's going to do, because it's all about Him. It's not about anyone else. It's about Christ. And if it's not Him, then we have failed and missed out anyway. As I thought about what I would present then tonight in the way of encouragement from the Word, I did want to say that we are encouraged specifically by three things there at the camp. One is the filling of the summer And already, and then with the Lord willing, addition of the two new camps and the other thoughts that we have, and then also with the avenues that he's opening, I've been working with about 10 new churches with retreats, and then we've been working with some schools for back-to-school retreat, and we're just very thankful that the year is filling up for next year, and as we just trust him to bring in the people and the groups that he wants there. And so we've been thankful for that as we had such a wonderful summer and just filled, and then next year looks to be just as well. And then another area that we've been encouraged is in the area of help, as we have had many people to offer help and to come and to partner along with us and to be a part of the camp. It's your camp. And so there's no reason why you shouldn't be a part of it and to come and to help and to offer. And so we've been thankful for that. And as we are making known our intentions for next summer, we have a large number of people who are interested in coming and helping and being a part of that in different areas, counseling and so on. And we thank the Lord for that, for those that make the desserts and have brought them along, and just a big help as well. And then the third area that I wanted to mention is in the area that we've noticed now for some time, and that is in the area of we have many gifted young people that come to our camp, and especially our weeks that we have for the EMC weeks. And our goal is to try to incorporate them more and more into the worship services, as we see a great talent in music and singing and playing the instruments and just being involved in that way. And so what greater place for them to practice and to put forth their talents than at the camp. And so we hope to incorporate that into the worship services more so in the coming year. And we also hope to use some of our own young adults in the area of ministry. We have many young adults, young men and women who are talented in the area of ministry, whether it's singing or doing the music or speaking. And so we hope to use our own in the ministry and in the services that we have. So we ask that you would continue to pray with us and to continue to come alongside of us and encourage us. We're going to look tonight in Lamentations chapter 3. And as you're turning there, we'll get to it directly. And we'll be looking there in verses 21 through 24, really to wrap up the message of this evening. But as I thought about what issues do we see, not only at the camp, but also I see in working with young people and young adults at the school and at the college, also at the church, and I think these two issues are common. And I don't think that I would be mistaken to say that they're probably pretty evident in most of your evangelical fundamental churches, as well as your schools, colleges, camps, or anything else in the ministry area. One of those issues is that you find people asking, is life worth living? And in Ecclesiastes, Solomon discusses that very question as he looks at the world around him, and in the postmodern world that we live in, many times you see that the answer is no, not really. And the reason that's given is found there in the first three chapters of Ecclesiastes. And the first reason it's giving is that life is just monotonous. It's boring. And it's the same thing every day. Really no different. I get up and talk to the young people at school. You know, you get up and you get up about 5:45 and you get ready and you eat your breakfast and you brush your teeth and you get your books and you head off to school and you stay there all day, and it's the same classes, the same teachers, same people, same stuff every day. Maybe for those that are working, I get up at 5:45, I get ready, I eat my breakfast, I brush my teeth, I go to work. It's the same drive, it's the same people I work with, the same job, the same office, the same cubbyhole, whatever it might be. And when I'm finished with the day, then I come home, and maybe if I'm in school, I might have some activities, maybe I go to soccer practice, maybe not. I have homework, and then before long, it's time to go to bed, and then I take a bath, go to bed, get up, and do the same thing the next day. And so life is monotonous. It's the same thing. The second reason that is given there in Ecclesiastes is that wisdom seems to be a vain thing. We learn and we learn and we learn, and man pushes forward, and there's more things that are learned, and we're in the great technological revolution. But it all seems to be a waste, because man really isn't getting any better, which certainly blows out the evolutionary mind that we're supposed to be getting better. Baltimore recently got the honors of being the murder capital of the world again, with almost 300 murders already this year. So man's not evolving into a better creature. And so what is the use of all this wisdom? Because man doesn't seem to be getting better. In fact, you look at the world around you and it seems to be getting worse. So what's the use of going to school and learning and gaining wisdom? The futility of wealth. You look at people who are wealthy, and they don't really appear to be very happy. Recently, I've had dealings with those that seem to be doing better financially, but they're not any happier than they've ever been. Because certainly wealth does not get you happiness or make you any more content. So what's the use? What's the use of going to school and getting an education and getting a good job and making lots of money? Because money can't buy you the things that you're looking for anyway. So why bother? You deal with this, at least we do, all the time. What's the point? And then to wrap it up, the fourth reason that life isn't worth living is the certainty of death. You're going to die anyway. So what's the point? I grew up, and in my high school years, it has dawned on me that really that was the dawning age of the postmodern movement. And what I mean by that is that we have moved into an area where there is no truth, there are no absolutes, there's really no right or wrong. And one of the greatest dangers is that what has come about is that it's really not worth it. What's the point? We had a saying when I was in high school, life stinks, then you die. Kind of a depressing outlook on life, isn't it? We live in a depressed time. 15 million American teenagers, 18 and under, take antidepressants every single day. Now, I realize that there is the need for those, and I'm not even addressing the issue of chemical imbalances and things that are like that. But what I am saying is that the postmodern movement, which has permeated our society, is a depressing view of life. And so it affects our young people that we are dealing with. And if you don't believe so, you are foolish. 15 million every single day. And it's not just young people. I have dear friends that live in Alabama. And every day, they take antidepressants just so they can go to their job that they hate. Which to me makes absolutely no sense at all. Our family knew a family, and Jackie would know him very well, and probably will when I speak of him. A man that my father knew, who owned a very big house, huge, and he worked at the Tennessee Eastman. And he went there every day during the week and worked, and I remember him telling my father that every day when he got up, he was sick to his stomach because he hated going to that place to work every day. And he could hardly stand it. But yet there he went until he died of a heart attack before he ever got to enjoy the house, the retirement. So, as we deal with that, is life worth living? Thankfully, the Scripture doesn't leave us there.
with, no, it's not, and here are the reasons why. And Solomon, being the wise man that he is, doesn't leave their answers there either. Society and the world would lead us to believe that life isn't worth living because of those reasons. But Solomon looks at the monotony of life and he says, life's not monotonous. Look up and you will see that there is someone who is sovereign, someone who is Lord, someone who is in control of your life, and the everyday things that you think are monotonous, he is laying those out for you. The righteous man's ways are ordered by the Lord. And not only can we look up and see that life is not monotonous, but look within you. Look within your soul. Those that belong to Christ, those that know Him, then you have the abiding Spirit of God who lives inside of you, who controls you, who deals with you, convicts you, encourages you to go this way and to go that way. How do I know to go to the right or to go to the left? The Spirit of God speaks within my ear, the prophet says. And I know then, go to the right, go to the left, or don't go anywhere. Not only do we look up and look within, but then we are to look ahead. We're to look at our future. We're to look at that which is in front of us, not that which is behind us. There's nothing we can do about that. There's nothing that I can do about yesterday or even this morning. I look ahead and what Christ has prepared for me. And yes, as I look ahead, I realize that there are things that are unavoidable. There will be disappointments. There will be disasters. There will be sickness. There will be death. But yet, as I look ahead, I realize then all those things that are coming my way, even the bad things, let me know. Life is anything but monotonous. We do not know. And then it says that we are to look around us. And Solomon goes to four different places and he looks. And he looks there in the lawyer's office in front of the judge. And he looks in the marketplace. And he goes and he looks at the roadside and people traveling back and forth. And then he comes home. And he sits there in his house and he looks at everything that's going on. And so he sees people in their everyday lives. And he sees them as they're going up and down the road. And if we went out tonight and we went to the highway and we're just watching the cars, we would be amazed. You wouldn't want to get too close. You'd probably get run over. But just the number of people, and they're going here and they're going there. And it makes me think of the song, "People Need the Lord." Every day they pass me by. That lonely look in their eye. Going to who knows where. I don't know where they're going. You look up in the sky, really, at any given time, and you probably can see a plane going. People are just going and going. Look in your own home, he says. The activity of your children, your wife, your husband, your grandchildren. Life is anything but monotonous. And he closes off by saying, as an answer to each one of these, we are to enjoy life. Many times, people look at Christianity and they think that if I'm going to become a Christian, then I must stop enjoying life. And part of that is because they don't understand, but I believe part of it is because they look at Christians and they see people who are not very happy. They see people who are not very encouraging by their lives that they're living. They're depressed. Downtrodden, down in the mouth. Life is horrible. Life is terrible. Oh, by the way, don't you want to come to church with me on Sunday? He addresses the issue of wisdom, and he says, you know, wisdom's not a vain thing. If we use wisdom correctly, we can make life better. And I have to ask, isn't our lives better in the general sense today than they were in the past. Now, I realize there are a lot of things that are worse. But I don't know about you, but I enjoy not having to go outside to go to the bathroom. Just a common thing. Nothing out of the ordinary here. But I enjoy, I don't miss, you know, I never had to do that. And I don't really want to. Wisdom can make things better. And there's nothing wrong with things being better. Nothing wrong with that. Wisdom not only makes life better, but it also, in time, makes life clearer. And I can say to you, being 40, that I see things much clearer than I did when I was 20. I see things much clearer than I did when I was 30. I see things much clearer than I did when I was 35. And I'm sure as I go along when I am 50, and when I am about to turn my father-in-law's age, I will see things even more clear. Because with wisdom, hopefully, comes clarity as to what you see. That's why the Scripture is so full of the older telling the younger and leading them and being the example. And that's why it's a disaster whenever the older doesn't do that. And that's why we're in the mess we're in today. We often blame the young people. And perhaps many times it's their fault for being rebellious and stiff-necked. But there's also blame when the older aren't teaching the younger. How can they learn unless they be taught? And so it goes both ways. And then wisdom also makes us approach life stronger. As you obtain wisdom, are you not then given the strength to meet the new trials, to meet the new responsibilities, to meet the new obstacles that come your way? And the reason that you can meet them and overcome them is because you have the experience and the wisdom and the strength that comes from that. And so wisdom is not a vain thing. It's only vain if we misuse it or abuse it or stay away from it. We can use it to make our lives better, clearer, and stronger. And he ends that with saying, enjoy life. The futility of wealth. And we often look at wealth and we think that the only way that I can be a Christian is to be poor. And we misuse the Scripture where it talks about that it's easier. And we know the rest of that story, the rich man and the camel and so on. But I would say to you that wealth, whatever it is, whether you have a dollar tonight, or you have $1,000, all of us must admit that we are wealthy. Every one of us are wealthy. The wealth that you have is not measured in the zeros behind the dollar sign. But the wealth that you have been given is the responsibility and the opportunity to use whatever that is for the joy of the Lord and to reach others for Him. And so whether I give $1, as was mentioned already this evening, or I give $10,000, if it's not for the joy of the Lord, then I would as soon not have given it. But if it is, then there's no difference between the two. Wealth can be employed, Solomon says, to our advantage. That is, you take money and you make it work for you. There's the old saying that it takes money to make money. And so you are to employ your wealth. We are to be wise stewards of it. We are to learn from mistakes and to obtain wisdom in employing our money. Money in itself is not the evil. It's the attractions and the distractions that it brings that lead us to sins. And then we are told that we are to enjoy our wealth. And if you ever want a reference, go to Ecclesiastes, and I believe it's chapter 9, and I'll get the exact verse for you. But the implication is that we are to take our family on a vacation. It's found in the Scripture that we are to use the wealth that we have for the betterment of those within our household. And it goes on to explain what that betterment is. But we are to employ our wealth, and we are to enjoy our wealth. The employing it comes first. That is, making it work. That which is God's is given to God. That which is the government's, sad to say, goes to the government. And to the bills, goes to the bills. But that which we can enjoy, we enjoy. And it's a biblical principle. And so as we look at these things, and we look at the certainty of death, and certainly we understand it's unavoidable. But that doesn't mean that we should go ahead and embrace it right away. Life isn't worth living because I'm going to die, so I'll just go ahead and die. That doesn't even make any sense. Realizing that life is an uncertain thing, and that death is certain, and it's unavoidable, then that should encourage us to live. Knowing that death is coming, I have that appointment. I can't predict when it is, but I know it's unavoidable, so therefore, until that time, I choose to live. And he tells us again in concluding that, enjoy your life. And so not only should we choose to live then, but to live well. And living well doesn't mean that you have to have steak. It does mean you have to have Pepsi. But not necessarily steak. Living well. Living in Christ. Enjoying life. But you know, we really don't deal too many times with people who are dealing with whether or not they should live. That is, they're wanting to kill themselves, even though that is a reality. One of the startling statistics that I've came across this fall has been the number of young people that kill themselves every year continues to rise, but it's the divide. You would think that the number of young people killing themselves, there would be a large margin coming from families who are not Christians, who are alcoholics or have bad things going on in their life. But the breakdown actually is 46% come from evangelical fundamental families that have really no big problems that you see. 54% do come from those, what we would call dysfunctional families. But it's almost an even divide. There's really no difference, it seems. And that's a disturbing thing. But what I find is that not is life worth living, but this is the question. Is the Christian life worth living? Because we live our lives, but we can be living, but be dead. And we can be dead, but be living. And what I mean by that is that as Christians, and we deal most of the time with Christians, those that are professing to be Christians, at the camp, the majority of those that come in are from our churches, and they are professing Christians. At the school, they're all coming from Christian families and Christian homes, professing to be Christians. At the church, majority of my people profess to be Christians. But I find a disconnect with actually living the Christian life. And I think that it's because they've looked at the question, is living the Christian life worth it? And they look at the world as they did in Ecclesiastes, and the answer is no. They look at Christians around them, and they look at the things that they see in their lives. And sad to say today, just like there really doesn't seem to be much difference between those that are killing themselves coming from normal homes and those that are not from normal homes, There really doesn't seem to be a big difference today between those who are claiming to know Christ and living for Him and those who make no such claims at all. As you go into the world and as you see them at the workplace and as they go home and the children see the home life, and there is a difference there than what is going on or said in the church. That is, it's not being lived out at home. We stand in great need of Christian examples for our young people. Those that we could point to, this is someone who is living the Christian life. I was listening to someone yesterday, and they were talking about passing on information, and they were talking about genealogy and that sort of thing, and they were saying that with the passing of each person, each generation, that there's less and less known about their families. Because, and even in our own family, I can see that, because my brother Wayne is trying to research all this, and now my dad's gone, and all the aunts are gone pretty much, and the one that could tell them, her memory's going in and out. And so with each generation, the knowledge seems to be not passed on. We have to make sure that doesn't happen to us within the church. As each generation comes, and as the older ones pass on, who is going to pass on the information to them? Is the Christian life worth living? And if it is, then are we living it worthwhile? Living the Christian life involves, really, one thing. And that's having a personal relationship with God. And when you talk about, do you have a personal relationship with God, you get a lot of different answers. But the second thing that I am concerned about is that there is a great deal of knowledge today. A lot of people that you talk with and deal with know a lot about God. They can tell you a lot about God. They can tell you a lot of things about Christ. Some can even tell you a lot of things about doctrine. And that's pretty impressive. Some of those young people that we deal with can tell you a lot about the church and about the particular denomination, and that's great. And even within the church, you have those that are knowledgeable. But that is not, in itself, a personal relationship with God. And I believe that there is a disconnect between having the knowledge and having a personal relationship with God. A personal relationship with God is one that is spiritual. God says that He is a spirit, and if we are to worship Him, we will worship Him in the Spirit. I can say that I know President Bush. I've read books by him, about him. I have seen him over the last 7 years on the news in good light and bad light. I have read much that's been said about him. I've seen him on the TV numerous times, heard his speeches numerous times. I know a lot about him. But I don't know him. You see, there's a difference. I've never met the man. And even if I've met the man and shook his hand, I still can't say that I know him. Because knowing someone is an intimate thing. Getting to know them is different than knowing about them. In your relationships, as you get to know a person, you learn a lot of things about them. But as you become intimate with them and as that relationship grows, you begin to know more about them. And there is a difference. between the two. I know about a lot of people, but I don't know them personally. And my fear is that there is a growing number that know a lot about God, but they don't know Him. And there is a difference. And sometimes when you say that, people look at me with an absent look because they don't understand. There is a difference between knowing about someone and knowing them in a personal way. It is a spiritual relationship. It's one that absolutely must be centered around Jesus Christ. God Himself says that we do not approach Him unless we come through His Son, Jesus Christ. The only way that I can get to know God, which is an absolute, if I'm going to have a personal relationship with Him, is I must come through Christ. We live in a time where 54% of the evangelical congregation says there are many ways to know God. And that is an absolute lie. There is only one way to know God, and that is through His Son, Jesus Christ. There are those that know about Jehovah. There are those that know about the God of Abraham. There are those that know about the God of Islam, Allah. But they don't know God, because they can't know Him until they first know His Son, Jesus Christ. A personal relationship with God involves knowing Him. I can't know Him until I come to know His Son, and through Him, then I can know the Father. And so there is a difference in saying that we know about God and actually having a personal relationship with God. Not only must it be spiritual and must it be centered around Jesus Christ, but it is one that requires submission. To know God requires me to submit myself to Him. That is part of knowing Him, is to be submissive unto Him. He tells us that He is a jealous God. In Isaiah, He says that He is a possessive God. In Exodus 20, He says that He will not be one of many gods, but that He is the one God. I don't know any man that would be satisfied with being one of the boys in his wife's eye. Neither do I know any lady that would be satisfied with just being one of the girls in her husband's eye. What do we expect? When she walks into the room, she has my attention, and there's nobody else like her. When he walks into the room, he has her attention. There's nobody else like him. Why? Because that is the way it's supposed to be. That is the intimacy of it. And may I say to you that God is the same way in our relationship with Him. There will be no others. There will be no others. He makes that very clear. How many times in our relationship with God has there been others? It requires submission. Not only does it require submission, but then it has to be a mutual understanding. Jack and I laugh sometimes about some individuals we have known who you would think that they have met the girl of their dreams. And they are going to be married. And they have their whole life planned out. And you get to talking to them and you find out that the girl doesn't know anything about it. He's got everything planned out, but he hasn't told her yet. And so the relationship isn't mutual. And most of the time, it doesn't become mutual either. A relationship requires it to be mutual. Otherwise, it's not much of a relationship. If a husband or a wife is trying to carry on a relationship and the partner is not participating, that's not much of a relationship. And it usually won't last. And I believe that's why so many get into trouble. Because you have a one-sided relationship. Is our relationship with God one-sided? Or has He been affected by us? Do you realize that God is affected? He is pleased. He is disappointed. Do we have a mutual relationship with God? Is it one that He's pursuing us? Or is it one that we half-heartedly pursue after Him? I say this kindly, but I'm afraid that we pursue after the things of the world far more heartedly than we do after God. There are times when I pursue after the next meal more than I've pursued after God. There are times that I've pursued after money and trying to get things fixed financially far more than I've pursued after the heart of God. Is it a mutual relationship? You see, having a personal relationship with God is more than what we often think. It's more than just coming and attending church, doing our time, paying our money in. It is a relationship. It also is to be a growing relationship. We should never be satisfied with where our relationship is. We're always trying to improve it, always trying to get closer. In a relationship with a husband and wife or any type of relationship, if you don't try to keep it going, if you don't try to keep it growing, then if you're not growing, you become stale and sour and stagnant and going backwards. My relationship with God is one that should continually be growing. I'm wanting to get closer to Him. All right, I screwed up today. The Lord, tomorrow I want to do better. I realize I did that wrong. I shouldn't have said that. I shouldn't have went there. I shouldn't have acted that way. I want to do better. I want to grow in you. Our relationships with each other, with our spouses, is to be one of growth or it will be one of decline. How many times does God use the same parallel in our relationship with Him as He does with the relationship between the husband and the wife? Over and over again. He uses it as an illustration. And if my relationship with her is not growing, it is declining. And if my relationship with God is not growing, it's declining. There's never a point that I can become satisfied. Regardless of what area I am or season in life that I am, it doesn't matter. I'm always to be growing in the Lord, trying to get closer, trying to do better, trying to improve, trying to please Him. You remember what it was like when you wanted to do everything you could to please her or to please Him? Driving a snowstorm from Altoona in a car that, well, is only God's grace. Do we still try so hard to please each other? We should. Then what about God? From time to time, I really try to please Him, and I want to do what He wants, but so many times, I find myself not even caring. Because I'm so busy living. So busy with all those things. Just the honesty of it is there are times when my relationship with God really wasn't that important. Why? How can I say that? Because other things were far more important. There are times that I have to admit that I wasn't as excited to be near Him or with Him as other times. Personal relationship involves growing. Acknowledging those times and moving forward, doing better. And then finally, a personal relationship with God is one that is shared. Whenever you met him or you met her, the excitement was so intense that you could hardly wait to tell your best friend or your best girlfriend or your mom and dad. Take them home to see the family, even though you warned them about the family first. You take them home all the way to Tennessee, and you tell them, you know, people in Tennessee are a little bit different than what you're used to. And she would come to understand that well. But you're so excited. You couldn't wait to share them with someone else. Do we feel that same way about God? I can't wait to share him with someone else. Anyone. I'll tell anyone. I just can't wait. A personal relationship is shared. It's not kept in and hidden, afraid to come out. In fact, it can't help itself. The prophet said, there is something burning inside of me, and I can't stand it. And I can't wait. Nothing else is on your mind. Dad doing construction work? Always hated when one of us would fall in love because we were worthless on the workplace. Because we had nothing else on our mind but getting home, making a phone call, or going on a date. Of course, we did want to get paid so that we would have money to go. But nothing else was on our mind. And I would say today that many times he's the furthest thing from our mind. What type of personal relationship do I have with God? It is one that will be shared. Lamentations then, and then we're done. I told you we would get there. You are not used to me preaching so long. For the last half year, my people have been going through withdrawal. Because after 5 years, I feel like it was time to notch it up, and I preach to about a quarter after 12 now. I'm almost finished. Lamentations chapter 3 and verses 21 through 24. I hope that we can bring it all together. Is life worth living? Is the Christian life worth living? The answer, of course, is absolutely yes, but we don't always live that through. And I believe that the reason that we don't live that through and why there's so many questions about, is it worth living? Is it worth the trouble? Is it worth it? Should I do that? Should I go off to Bible school? Should I go to the mission field? It's because there's a lacking in our personal relationships with God. And so Lamentations chapter 3, you have to get in your mind the picture of where Ezekiel finds himself. It's about 580 BC, somewhere in there. And Jerusalem has been destroyed. The temple has been destroyed. The walls of Jerusalem have been destroyed. And the prophet stands in the midst of them, and he is weeping and he is crying. And he begins to talk about all the things that are bad in life, and he begins to talk about all the things that are wrong in life, and he begins to talk about what's happened. The walls are down, and the city's destroyed. Oh my, what are we going to do? And then he comes to verse 21, and he says, however, this I recalled to my mind, and because of this, therefore have I hope. It is of the Lord's mercies and His compassions that we are not consumed and that we do not fail. God's mercies are never ending. You can read the Psalms, and I believe it's about 120 times in the Psalms. It talks about His mercies endureth forever. How long is forever? Forever is a long, long time. His mercies endure forever. And if it were not for His mercies, we would have been consumed. But it's because of that that we have not been, and it's because of that that we have hope then. And not only because of His mercies, but His compassions as well. They fail not. It is the same ideal as infallible. When we say that the Bible is infallible, we say that it cannot fail. The same ideal is here. His compassions will not fail. They can't. They will never, never fail. They can't fail. It's an impossibility for His compassions to fail us. And because of that, then, He says, I have hope. It is of the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed. And then in verse 23, which has been for a while one of my favorite verses in Scripture, these mercies and these compassions are new every morning. Every morning that we awake, my friends, we are reminded not only that God is still there and that the world is still going on and the sun's coming up, it's a new day, but we are reminded from this passage that every new day, I have a new beginning. I have new mercies extended to me. I have new compassions that are given to me. I have forgiveness of that which was past. It's a new day. It's a new beginning. It's a new opportunity. It's a new responsibility for the new day that He has given to us. Every day, we can start again. Every day, I can start over and I can live a life that's worth living. I can live the Christian life and say, yes, it is worth living, and be an example to my children and to others and say, yes, living for Christ is worth it all. Every day, a new day comes that I can develop that personal relationship with God. Not only with my spouse, but with God. I have a new opportunity to make sure that it is spiritual, centered around Christ, submissive, mutual, growing, and then I share it this day. Every morning, it is new. Thank God for the morning as it reminds us of His faithfulness. That great hymn comes from this verse. Great is thy faithfulness. Every morning that comes, we can sing that song and we can be revived and renewed. And I would leave you with that encouragement that every day is a new day in Jesus Christ. Father, I thank You for our time of being together. I thank You for the truth of Your Word.